Welcome to another edition of Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of things culturally considered around the Bay Area. I'm Kevin Vance, sitting in for David LaTulipe, who should be back next week. We're going to be talking about dance theater here in the Bay Area. One of the great theater directors of the Bay Area is here to tell us about a wonderful event that's happening this weekend, in fact, opening tonight. We'll also hear about jazz at the Lesher Center in Walnut Creek. Yes, there is jazz in Walnut Creek, and there is Noel Coward at Stanford as well. Peter Robinson will be in to tell us about that event, that festival coming up. Stay with us. One event that's coming up this weekend here in the Bay Area that I'm particularly excited about is a performance of Emily Johnson, fine dancer originally from Alaska, makes her home in Minnesota, and the company Catalyst's Shore. Ain Gordon is the theater director of this event. It is opening tonight, Hiroshima Day, the 6th of August. 8 p.m. performance tonight, 8 p.m. performance Friday night, and a 2 p.m. performance on Saturday. So just three performances at the ODC Theater, 3153 17th Street in San Francisco. A telephone number for information is 415-863-9834, and a website is odcdance.org. Ain Gordon, welcome to KALW.
Hi.
So, Emily Johnson, we were hoping that she would be here today, and it makes a lot of sense that she, as the principal dancer of this event, is doing some elaborate warming up as well she should, as this is opening night. So, tell us about Catalyst, tell us about Shore, tell us about Emily Johnson.
As you said, Emily is from Alaska originally and now lives in Minneapolis, and that is where we originally built this show. It premiered there about a year ago. And we were thinking about a bunch of things, in particular, both literal and figurative shorelines between past and present, between communities, between history, between land you know and land you don't know, and in fact, even between the audience and the performer, and trying to enact a crossing of those shorelines in a performance arena. So the work does include both what we call the large cast, which is a movement choir, and a vocal choir, who are drawn from the local community in every city and who rehearse with us for a whole week to get up to speed and to sing in the performance, to move in the performance, and the performance actually begins outside and moves into the theater, crossing yet another shoreline.
What will people be seeing? You say you actually start outside and then move into the actual theater.
Yes, we are actually starting in Graffiti Alley, which is about 8 blocks away from the ODC Theater, and they will be both seeing the movement and vocal choir there, and then it ends in a story that Emily tells, which prepares you for the walk into the theater. And when you arrive in the theater, you will encounter the core cast who travels with the show and all of the singers and movers who are in the piece.
Wow. So she'll be so how many blocks away from the theater?
About 8 blocks.
8 blocks. Yeah. Will she, like, lead people from?
We walk in silence all together with some vocal accompaniment and sound accompaniment that is performed as we go.
Where is Graffiti Alley?
Gosh, I am new to the city, so I couldn't tell you exactly where it is.
We all should collectively Google it just to know exactly where that is. Go ahead.
Yell. Clarion Alley.
Clarion Alley.
Yes.
Clarion Alley, and that's the end of Clarion Street, I assume.
Yeah, it's right in the Mission. If you Google it, you will find it. In fact, many tourists are there, so we are often performing, rehearsing amid tourists and amid people restoring the murals, which are mostly protest murals.
Mm. Well, how many people are involved in this project? Musicians, dancers?
There are three core dancers, Emily, Aretha, and Krista, and myself, the director. There is a choir director who travels with us, Margot. And then there are about 18 people in the movement choir and 8 people in the vocal choir.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big production.
The dance, the story will take us to all kinds of places, like you said. All kinds of places, real and imaginary?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a kind of personal, emotional investigation of the question of shorelines rather than a literal narrative investigation of it. But definitely parts of every person's heritage is buried in the making of it. And I think also questions about every person's individual history are buried in how we generated the material. So it is a very personal and very inhabited piece of abstraction.
Not just, because I know about Emily Johnson growing up in Alaska in a little village in a native setting, mm-hmm. A Yupik. And, mm-hmm. You say other people who live here in North America that will be able to relate to the story because we all came over from one shore or another.
I think so. And also, while we've been here, we've been partnering with some of other organizations who will be part of the feast, which happens on Sunday. We've been working with the Ohlone Profiles Project and with Literacy for Environmental Justice. So there is a different kind of reach out into the community, various communities, which is part of the project and part of kind of making the connection between what we've been thinking about with what other people in the area are already thinking about and how they are like-minded.
Tell me about the feast.
The feast will be on Sunday. You can get there any time between 2 and 5, and you eat at 6 o'clock. And if you bring something to share, that's great. There will be some food there already. There will be some performances at the feast, including some material from the show and some material from what we do outside in the alley. And also the Dave Smith Point Arena Manchester Pomo dancers will be there. And I think also Circle of Nations dancers will be there. They're from Sacramento. So there will be a kind of culminating, more public, less stage-bound event that speaks to all the themes of the work.
A breakdown of the fourth wall, too, obviously performing amongst people.
Yes.
Not just being up on stage. There will be the moment of being on stage. But
even there, we have broken down the fourth wall quite aggressively. And the
really?
Audience, I mean, it's not aggressive to but aggressive to ourselves within the rehearsal process. And the dancers are really looking directly at the audience. They are very near the audience. Sometimes they are across that line of the stage. We are very much worked on being in the room together and not being in a separate space that is behind a fourth wall.
For people who don't know dance as well, modern dance, what will we be seeing? Will we be seeing modern dance? Will we be seeing indigenous dance, a combination of those things?
I think we will be seeing contemporary dance, which is kind of... modern dance is very aesthetically a certain period in time, which I have total respect for, and contemporary dance is kind of the next generation's look at that material. Certainly... Emily's heritage is within her body, and so it must come out in the way her body moves in space, but it is contemporary dance.
Contemporary dance. Thank you for the correction of my language.
Not a problem.
I'd love to hear the audition process. How did you pick all the people to dance or perform or play in this event?
You mean in terms of the guest choir and
everything, yeah. The dancers, the musicians?
Well, the core dancers are people that were really asked in terms of ongoing relationships. It's a very personal process and very, I think we are all kind of want to build on relationships that can go deeper and be deployed in performance as opposed to bring in somebody new to learn this set stage of movement. So that's pretty interpersonal. Bringing in the people who come in each city, there is a kind of audition process, but that audition process is a lot about, in a similar way, who shows up, who's willing to live through how confusing it might be at first, who can become inculcated, who offers something right away that you hadn't thought of. You know, essentially we are looking for short-term collaborators as opposed to filling in a preordained set of activities.
How much is this? It was choreographed in advance, and how much of it is improvised?
It is totally choreographed in advance. It is. I'm a bossy director, and it is way choreographed in advance, and in fact, micromanaged down to the tiniest moment. They have lots of liberty, but the liberty is very set and been very negotiated over months of development.
I would want somebody to be bossy and say, no, you don't step over there, you step over there.
Yes.
Ain Gordon is our guest here on Open Air. He is the theatrical director of an event that is appearing that begins tonight. It is the performance of Shore. Principal dancer and force behind this is Emily Johnson and Catalyst. Is Catalyst the name of the company?
It is.
Catalyst is the name of the company, and the event takes place tonight, tomorrow and evenings and Saturday afternoon at the ODC Theater here in San Francisco. The address is 3153 17th Street in the Mission District. A telephone number is 415-863-9834. A website is odcdance.org. I should know what ODC stands for.
Oberlin Dance Collective.
Oberlin Dance Collective. Excellent. Oh, one of the greatest.
Yes.
One of the greatest ones. What other work have you done, Ayn?
Well, I'm one of those many-hatted types. I'm a writer, director, actor. I have worked at the BAM Next Wave Festival. I've worked actually here in American Conservatory Theater a long time ago. I've worked at the Mark Taper in Los Angeles. I've written for Will and Grace. I'm kind of all over the place.
That's good. This
yes.
is good. Yeah. People say, well, you work in show business, but what do you do for a living?
Exactly.
You get a chance to do everything. That's
yeah.
good. So you work with actors and musicians
oh, yeah.
and dancers. And so this is just second hat for you, you know. But what do you have to do differently in this production that you've had to do in the past?
Well, you know, I think we've talked about this a lot, that I am very interested in narrative. I am a narrative artist, but I am definitely interested in the ways in which narrative can be deployed in a nonlinear sense. And what is emotional narrative? What is embodied narrative? What is a physical narrative? What is nonverbal narrative? And so Emily's work has a whole lot of narrative running through it, but it isn't storytelling. And so we have worked a lot on ways in which we can track those narratives and get the audience to see the narratives we're playing with without having to literally announce it.
I was going to say, is there really a difference between storytelling and narrative? Or I suppose there.
Well, there's a difference between verbally offering a story uh-huh. and physically or emotionally offering a story.
Okay. All right. This is the shortest part of a trilogy. Tell me about one and two.
The first one was called Thank You Bar. And the second one was called Nichugni. I did not work on the first two. I came into the third part of the trilogy. But they are all, I think, looking at, in some respects, aspects of Emily's heritage and home. This one, I think, is pushing out into a wider spectrum of investigation, the shoreline, as opposed to the home that might be before the shoreline.
Hmm. A question I wanted to ask Emily if she had been here. I'll pose it to you anyway.
See if I can answer.
Even though you're the director, you're also a performer, and you know how to work with people, and you know how to be on stage besides being behind it. One of the things that I marvel at watching a little bit of Emily Johnson's work on YouTube videos is it reminds of being able to perform in real life, not just on stage, but to be able to perform at the alley mm-hmm. This evening and leading people to the event. Many other times I see street performers who are really talented, who are really trying to put their art out there, and when they're really good, people really do notice. I always remember the story, a graffiti artist had one of his caricatures painted up on a wall that could be seen from the freeway. So many people would see this piece of art, and I would imagine the artist felt gratified knowing that people got to see his work all the time, assuming it was a he, mm-hmm. seeing the work on display. Is that gratification something else that Emily sort of seeks in the work that she's done? You've only worked with her on this project, right?
Yes, we were in a previous project with actually a new music ensemble, which was a collaboration between all of us. So we have had that. But this Emily project is the first time on her work. I think for Emily, I mean, the very question of the difference between performing in the street or performing for free or performing for people who don't expect to see you mm-hmm. and what happens in the theater and detonating that line and being as fully inhabited in the street and being as casual and available on the stage is something that she has worked with a lot and something that we have worked with on this project in particular to try and bring that immediacy and that sense of having happened upon something and being in the same room, whether we're in the alley or on the stage.
Mm. Three performances of Emily Johnson and Catalyst's Shore opening tonight. Performance tonight at 8 p.m., tomorrow evening at 8 p.m., and then Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. I would imagine it's a very taxing performance, just three performances as opposed to multiple weekends.
It is
Sunday matinees.
It is 75 minutes of dancing your tail off.
Wow. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this and seeing this. This sounds like an awesome event.
Yeah, please come. And Sunday is actually the feast at 2 o'clock. It's a little bit changed from what you have there. But
the feast is at 2 o'clock?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, is simultaneous to the performance?
Well, no, they're going to performances Friday and Saturday night, and Sunday is the feast.
Oh, Sunday is
Saturday,
the feast.
Saturday is the feast. Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I'm screwing you up, sorry.
Okay, that's right. Sunday, and then Sunday what time? 2 o'clock for the...
No.
Nothing, I'm sorry. Never mind.
Saturday at 5, well, you can come from 2 to 5. There'll be performances. There'll be things to see. The feast starts at 5, but you can come at 2 o'clock. That's what Emily told me today.
That's the Saturday performance for the event is Emily Johnson, Catalyst, and the piece is called Shore, taking place at the ODC Theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's opening tonight, mm-hmm. the 6th. Performance also tomorrow, the 7th. At 8 p.m. and Saturday at 2 p.m., the ODC Theater, 3153 17th Street, San Francisco. A telephone number for more information is 415-863-9834, and a website for more information is odcdance.org. Ayn Gordon, who's doing a lot of the very important work and making sure everybody's stepping in the right, making their marks. Thank you so much for all this work. I'm sure it's going to pay off. It's just going to be an awesome weekend.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, Ayn. Anything else you wanted to say?
Just come see the show. Come see the show.
Fantastic. An excerpt from the Dies Irae from the Requiem of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Kurschel 626. San Francisco Choral Society will be presenting Mozart's powerful and moving Requiem and the striking and uniquely expressive Vespere Solennis de Confessore. This will be taking place, you may go to City Box Office for ticket information. This concert will be taking place at a wonderfully acoustically rich venue called St. Ignatius' Church at the University of San Francisco, 650 Parker Street in San Francisco, Friday and Saturday, the 14th and 15th of August at 8 p.m. both those evenings. And one can go to Google and look up San Francisco Choral Society and find out about this performance of Mozart's Requiem. We're going to move from dance and Mozart to jazz. I'm very pleased to welcome to the KALW studio Tom Donahoe. Welcome to KALW. Tell us what you're doing there. When I think of jazz and Walnut Creek, I wonder. I don't think of the two being put together. I think of Walnut Creek having a wonderful performance center. But tell me about jazz at the Lesher Center.
Well, we're in our fourth summer season in presenting jazz at the Lesher Center. And in some ways, you're right, because jazz was missing from our lineup of performances at the Lesher Center for years. And it was one that I and others were just dreaming about bringing to the Lesher Center. And so 4 years ago, we were successful in doing that and putting together our first season, four concerts in the summer. And when we announced the season, subscriptions sold out so fast that we added a 5 p.m. to our 8 p.m. performances right on the spot.
That's a good sign. That's an excellent sign.
And that's what we've been doing ever since. We do a 5 and an 8 p.m. concert on our Saturday nights during the summer.
Some people just like to go to an early show, too, as well, I would imagine.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was kind of skeptical about a 5 p.m., but people love it because you get out at a great time to go to dinner.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of great restaurants in Walnut Creek.
That's right. There are. It's a gorgeous downtown. I've spent a little time in downtown Walnut Creek, and there are some great places. It's not all shopping malls. It's actually a very nice, very nice downtown.
That's right. Yeah.
The Margaret Lesher Center, which I think of as a new addition to Walnut Creek. But it was built like what in the last 20 years?
25 years ago.
Really? Okay. So I mean, that seems like a long time ago, but it also seems so recent too. It's a big, beautiful building.
It is.
Sort of like Walnut Creek's answer to the Davies Center in
yes.
a way.
Yes. Right.
Is it? I've never been inside of it though. Is it gorgeous to listen to music to in there?
Yes. Well, there are three theaters. There's an 800-seat theater, the 300-seat theater, and a 150-seat theater. And the jazz series takes place in the 300-seat theater. So we are bringing in wonderful jazz artists and presenting them in the smallish theater, which is a wonderful experience. We do that on purpose because there's this wonderful relationship between the musicians and the audience in that theater.
I like an intimate venue because then I feel like I'm really close enough to the performers.
Yeah.
And they can tell we're there, too.
Well, we kicked off the season Saturday, this last Saturday, with the Clayton Hamilton Jazz Orchestra. So we had a 19-piece big band in that 300-seat theater. And I'm telling you, it was awesome. It was spectacular.
Did people try to dance?
No, but they stood up and clapped a lot.
That's good. This is good because they
shouted out a lot too.
Oh, I'm sure. It's call and response. That's what jazz is. You know, it's an old participatory back and forth improvisation and everything else. I'm really excited at some of the people that you have this year. Niels, I'm going to ask you to play a little Dick Hyman for us. But before we do, tell us about Dick Hyman, one of the great jazz piano people that you're going to be bringing to the Jazz at Lesher.
Well, I think Dick Hyman deserves the title legendary. He is a consummate pianist, can play any style. But he really loves the music of the 20s, but all the way through. But he can play piano beautifully, any way he chooses to play. And we had him a couple of years ago in a Stride Summit, Stride piano. This year we have him more in a swing mode, I guess you would call it, with tenor saxophonist Harry Allen and Ken Poplowski clarinet with the rhythm section. So it'll be a very different Dick Hyman. But, you know, he is 88 years old.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And he is still just playing marvelously. But for those who aren't really familiar with the name, you might recognize it because he was the musical director on 12 of Woody Allen's greatest movies.
That's where I know the name Dick Hyman then, yes.
Yeah, so, and he's had a very diverse career and is just a wonderful, wonderful piano player.
Can we listen to a little Dick Hyman? Here he is. Here's Dick Hyman. He's going to be one of the many appearing as part of Jazz at Lesher. Dick Hyman, one of the many musical voices appearing as part of Jazz at Lesher. His performance will be Saturday, the 8th of August, this coming Saturday, two shows at 5 p.m. and 8 p.m. at Lesher Center in the Margaret Lesher Theater at the Lesher Center for the Arts, 1601 Civic Drive in Walnut Creek. And that performance, as I said, Saturday, the 8th. As part of Jazz at Lesher, Tom Donahoe here to tell us more about that. And you say he's going to be joined by Ken and Harry playing other instruments. Ken Petlowski playing clarinet, and saxophonist Harry Allen, and then also jazz and bass guy as well.
Yes,
Leon Joyce and John Witala.
Right,
fantastic. What a treat that you got a chance to get Dick Hyman, because I've heard his name for many years. Another performer who's coming that I'm very excited that you have coming is Cyrus Chestnut, who I think is going to be the McCoy Tyner of the 21st century. I think he's
he may already be.
He may already, but McCoy is still around.
Yeah, it's
McCoy,
well, yes,
McCoy is still doing, still playing very well, live and well in the 21st century right now. But he's one of those young people who's just lets me know that jazz is in good hands, especially with the keyboard. Tell us, I know about Cyrus Chestnut. Why don't you tell the rest of the world about Cyrus Chestnut?
Well, as you say, he's a contemporary jazz pianist player, but who has roots in the blues and gospel, and brings a lot of creativity and originality to the, you know, to the stage and to the music. As a matter of fact, he came and performed for us 2 years ago, and when he came out on stage, he said to the audience, "If you're here to hear familiar tunes, you're in the wrong place. We play originals." And he's a wonderful person, very congenial. I think puckish is kind of a good word for him, and he's just a delight. And when he was here last time, we presented him with tenor sax and trumpet, and this time we've changed it up a little bit. We have the same great tenor sax player with him, Joel Fromm, but in place of trumpet, we're adding vibraphonist Warren Wolf, who is currently a member of the SF Jazz Collective Band, to bring a little different color to what Cyrus does on stage with his groups. So we're really looking forward to that.
Cyrus Chestnut appearing as part of Jazz at Lesher Center in Walnut Creek at the Margaret Lesher Theater on Civic Drive in Walnut Creek. The date for the Cyrus Chestnut show is August 22nd, which by this calendar says it's on a Saturday. Is that going to be another 5 and 8 p.m. show?
It's a 5 and 8 p.m. show.
Another 5 and 8 p.m., so you have your choice between the two. And then the following performance will be on the 29th, the final Saturday of the month of August, and you've got a jazz guitar duo, Martin Taylor and Bucky Pizzarelli. Tell me about them. I love jazz guitar, but I don't know about them.
Well, Bucky Pizzarelli, I think, along with Dick Hyman, deserves the title legendary.
Mm.
Bucky is 89 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
And he is still swinging. amazing person. His son's name, John Pizzarelli, who is very popular now as a jazz performer and who we have had twice. And Bucky's the father, so we're bringing him out. And so we're really looking forward to that. And Martin Taylor is a Brit. He is an extraordinary guitarist, absolutely extraordinary guitarist. And he's played with everyone. So it is going to be a very, very exciting concert. I know it is.
Are they going to play standards? Are they going to play originals?
Oh, I would imagine they're going to play standards because I don't know if they've ever played together before. So I kind of suspect they're going to be doing tunes that they know. But they'll probably also do some solo work, and I know Martin has some original compositions too.
And then after this is all over, you're waiting for 2016.
We're working on 2016. Yes.
Oh, I'm very excited about this. Let me recapitulate what's going on here. This is the Jazz at Leisure Center series. It already started last weekend with a great big band coming up this weekend. It is a performance of Dick Hyman and a jazz quintet. Two shows, 5 and 8 p.m. on Saturday the 8th. As I said, Cyrus Chestnut coming up on Saturday the 22nd of August with another great collection of supporting musicians. And then the jazz guitar trio Martin Taylor and Bucky Pizzarelli concluding this season, this trilogy, I guess it could be called, on the 29th, which is the final Saturday of the month of August. This is all taking place at Margaret Lesher Theater at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek, 1601 Civic Drive. And two shows on those Saturdays, the 8th, the 22nd, the 29th, 5 p.m. and 8 p.m. A telephone number for more information is 925-943-7469. A website is leisurejazz.org. All kinds of people coming to these shows, not just one particular demographic, but young and old.
Young and old, and from throughout pretty much the East Bay. And I might add that for your listeners in the South Bay, Hyman and Poplowski and Allen will be performing on Sunday at the Bankhead Theater in Livermore.
Oh, okay.
In Livermore.
Good.
So,
what's the date on that one?
Well, that's Sunday the 9th.
Sunday the 9th, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, and it's an afternoon performance, and I don't know whether it's 2 or 3, but your South Bay listeners might want to check that out, too.
Fantastic. How long have you been working on this project, on this Lesher Jazz series?
I think I started dreaming about this 10 years ago, and it took us some time to really pull things together. Every now and then we would raise the subject, see what we might be able to do, and then back off and then go at it again. But 4 years ago, when we brought the subject up again and decided to really pursue it, I was fortunate enough to know the director of Chamber Music San Francisco, and you have one of his brochures right over here, Daniel Levenstein.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because he brings his chamber music series to Walnut Creek, mm-hmm. and so I've developed a relationship with him, and I was talking with him about doing a jazz series, and he stepped in and has really done a professional job for us in working with booking artists and putting the series together and that sort of thing. So we've been very fortunate to be able to work with Daniel.
That sounds wonderful. Now, do you procure the artists yourself, or how do they come to you, or how do you come to them? How do you select who plays?
Well, the way it's been working is that Daniel and I just talk and talk and talk about how to put a series together. We only do 4 concerts, so we're really looking to kind of balance out the genres and balance out the instrumentation and take a look at the entertainment factor and, you know, all those kinds of things, just so that we have a series that will appeal to a to a broad audience. And then, you know, Daniel does the artist contact work for us and does a terrific job.
Tom Donahoe is our guest. He is one of the major forces behind Jazz at Lesher Center, presented by Diablo Regional Arts Association. It's in its fourth season, a stellar lineup continuing. Last week it was a fine big band. What was the name of the big band?
Hamilton Jazz Orchestra.
What was his story?
Well,
what is his story?
Well, there are two Claytons. John, who is the bass, Jeff is a multi-reed player, and then Jeff Hamilton is the drummer. And those three guys lead this band, and there are people who will tell you this is the best big band in the country.
So these aren't locals.
Most of them are out of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
But the story is just not long ago, they went back to Lincoln Center and had a big band bash with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra and cleaned them up. I may have gotten that a little prejudiced
That's what jazz bands do. They cleaned up. That sounds good.
having listened to them, I can believe it. They're a spectacular band.
Well, I think also major congratulations on being able to get Dick Hyman. He'll be performing this Saturday, 5 p.m. and 8 p.m. And again, the great Cyrus Chestnut on the 22nd, as well as the jazz guitar trio Martin Taylor and Bucky Pizzarella. This is happening all at the Margaret Lesher Theater at the Lesher Center for the Arts, 1601 Civic Drive, Walnut Creek, Saturdays 5 and 8 p.m. Website for more information is lesherjazz.org. A telephone number is 925-943-7469. Tom, thank you so much. Anything I left out?
I don't think so. I think it's wonderful. Thank you.
I want to share the little buzzing in the background is my little hamster driven computer here. And what I want to do is I want to share with you a little bit of Cyrus Chestnut here from his latest recording called Midnight Melodies. This is a tune called Naima's Love Song.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Desert Inn takes great pleasure in presenting Mr. Noel Coward.
Whenever spring breaks through again, time may lie heavy between, but what has been is past forgetting. Dance, 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 little lady, youth is fleeting to the rhythm beating in your mind. Dance, 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 little lady, so obsessed with second best, no rest you'll ever find. Time and tide and trouble never, never wait. Let the cauldron bubble, justify your fate. Dance, 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 little lady, dance, 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 little lady, leave tomorrow behind. The life you lead sets all your nerves a-jangle. Your love affairs are in a hopeless tangle. Though you're a child, dear, your life's a wild typhoon. In lives of leisure, the craze for pleasure steadily grows. Cocktails and laughter, but what comes after, nobody knows. You're weaving love into a mad jazz pattern, ruled by pantaloons. Poor
poor little rich girl, don't drop a stitch too soon. We'll be as happy and contented as birds upon a tree, high above the mountains and the sea. We'll bill and we'll coo.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next voice you hear will be that of longtime open-air contributor Peter Robinson. Peter, welcome back.
Hi, Kevin. Good to be here. And we're not coming from the desert sands in Las Vegas. We're here at KLW 91.7 FM. And my guest today, Rush Rehm, is the director of the Nelkard Festival at Stanford University. It's a cornucopia of wonderful Coward performances, movies, plays. I've just been to the symposium, and shortly coming is the Coward Cabaret, and Rush himself is appearing in Hay Fever. But just before I introduce him, I just want to welcome listeners who remember my old friend Alan Farley. I worked with him for 20 years, and every Friday evening on the dot at 8:30, he would have a five-minute Noel Coward interview. So, Alan, if you're listening up there in the skies, welcome one more time to the master, Noel Coward. Rush, good to have you on the program today.
Great to be here, and great to be working on Noel Coward.
And tell us a little bit about what's been happening at Stanford, because I know this is a wide range of Coward performances that you've been giving down there.
Yes, well, this is the 17th year of Stanford Repertory Theater, of which I'm the artistic director, and every year we do a different theme or playwright. This summer we're working on Noel Coward. And as you pointed out, in addition to doing Hay Fever, we're doing Coward Cabaret. We have seven films in our film series, each introduced by an expert. A couple weeks ago we had Toby Wolf talking about the Coward's appearance in Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana. And also we have a symposium, as you pointed out, where people talk to a general audience about Coward, his legacy. We managed to do scenes from plays that are very rarely done, his anti-war play called Postmortem, also Nude with Violin, about art and the art market. And as you pointed out, our cabaret opens next week and runs August 13th to the 23rd.
So tell me, you're appearing in Hay Fever. So how does this fit into the Noel Coward play section in terms of his life and his performances?
Yes. Well, Hay Fever was an extremely popular play he wrote in 1925. In 25, he had, I think, three plays and a musical running at the same time at the West End. The Vortex, Hay Fever, and Fallen Angels, and also one of his music reviews. Pretty soon after that, Private Lives, Design for Living. So he was in the 20s and 30s, perhaps, I would say without a doubt, the most popular writer of plays and musicals in the English language. And in the late 20s, he was the highest paid author in the world, something people forget. He had a falling off after World War II. People were interested in social drama, but he had a renaissance in the 60s when his friend Laurence Olivier, who was running the National Theater, mounted Hay Fever as a revival. And that from that time on, Coward has never been out of the repertoire.
Now, I always think when it comes to advice to actors, the lyrics of Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage, Mrs. Worthington, is something he claims he wrote in a ship's cabin coming back from the Far East and approached once again by an anxious mother who felt that her daughter was the ideal for a young performance. And I think that's how the song came about. Is that right?
Yes, I think there was a talent show on the boat. Having been on a boat like that many, many years ago, that's what they do to pass the time. They're not drinking. And I think Coward witnessed this and, to his horror, was inspired to write the song, Mrs. Worthington.
Put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded, and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too developed for her age? I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage. Regarding yours,
dear Mrs. Worthington, of Wednesday the 23rd. Although your baby may be keen on a stage career, how can I make it clear this is not a good idea for her to hope? Dear Mrs. Worthington, is on the face of it absurd. Her personality is not in reality exciting enough, inviting enough for this particular...
Yeah, I always remember one parody we did at the Footlights at Cambridge, changing the words slightly, and it was, "Don't put your daughter on the game, Mrs. Worthington." And then, of course, we won't repeat the next line after that, but that's how it went. Now, let's look for a second, if we could, Rush, at the 1940s, because in many ways he had an interesting and highly patriotic contribution to make to how things were going. And I know you ran that movie In Which We Serve. That would be a good example.
Yes, well, Coward, as I mentioned, he didn't serve in... Well, he was drafted in World War I, but he never fought at the front and tried to get out of it, I think. But with the rise of Hitler, Coward became one of those Englishmen who was very interested in resisting the rise of fascism. And when the war did break out, he actually went to the United States, sent by Churchill and others to try to get the United States interested in fighting. And he, as you pointed out, wrote the screenplay and sort of directed and starred in Which We Serve, which is one of the great propaganda films ever made because it's so mild-mannered and British in its patriotism. It's about the defeat, actually, of the sinking of a British ship and the killing of people in the Blitz. And you think if an American made the film, it would be about some triumph. But in English, it was actually about how the British keep going in spite of a defeat. So it's really quite wonderful as a film.
And he also had this happy breed.
That's right. And he was then sent by Churchill to Paris, not a bad gig until the Nazis occupied it, to work with the Ministry of Information and try to do some sort of low-level spying, which he wasn't very successful at. Nothing really happened. He was bored, actually. And then they sent him on a series of entertaining the troops, and he went all over the world. He went to South Africa. He actually wrote Nina, famous Nina from Argentina, was actually written for the troops in South Africa. Got the idea from a train trip. He was in Burma, in the Far East, singing. And many of the songs he would actually write because he sang by himself or with a couple of other people and a pianist. So he did. He served in that capacity.
And I think, too, if we just looked at the lyrics, Don't Let's Be Beastly to the Germans, you've got a lot of flag-waving going on there and a kind of recognition that there's two sides to the argument.
Well, that's true. It's a wonderful song, as you probably know. It was censored. People didn't get the irony of it. It was in a review. He wrote it originally, and then it was put into a review, and then it was taken out of the review because the government didn't like it. They didn't get it, but it's a terrific song. It's great, great history. People think Coward just wrote froth, but he wrote wonderful sense of history. We'll help them occupy the Rhine again. We'll tell them that sterilization really isn't done. I mean, it's very, very witty in a time in which, of course, people needed some sort of uplift because it wasn't at all clear how the war was going to go when he wrote it.
And I think looking at the versatility of Coward's career, often today we speak about having a second career. And in fact, by the 1950s, he partly changed from plays to cabaret. And I think he developed that very casual conversational style that we associate largely with Las Vegas. And occasionally he'd take a lyric, like a Cole Porter lyric of Let's Do It, and he would then make it his own song. And I think that was part of his trick to take something established but give it an independent twist.
Absolutely.
Mr. Irving Berlin often emphasizes sin in a charming way. Mr. Coward, we know, wrote a song or two to show sex was here to stay. Richard Rogers, it's true, took a more romantic view of this sly biological urge, but it really was Cole who contrived to make the whole thing merge. He said that Belgians and Greeks do it, nice young men who sell antiques do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Monkeys, whenever you look, do it. Ali Khan and King Farouk, do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Luella Parsons can't quite do it, but she's so highly strung. Marlena might do it,
But she looks far too young. Each man out there shooting crap does it. Davy Crockett in that dreadful cap does it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Well, there we have Noel Coward in his very special version, down to Davy Crockett's hat, and thereby hangs a tale, does it, and so we have it. But I think from a point of view, this was a dark time in terms of Coward's attitude to the British theatre. People like John Osborne look back in anger, partly Arnold Wesker, The Kitchen, John Brain, some of his performances. And I think this is where Coward, I think, has an interesting sort of duality. He's highly conservative and at the same time can be extremely radical and reactionary. And I think looking at those 1950s period, this breakthrough into cabaret at Las Vegas and other places does show how to transition sometimes.
Yes, I concur completely. Some of his politics are, I find, quite frightening. But on the other hand, I think perhaps because he hung around with bohemians, he was very a self-made man. He never went to proper school. He never went to college. Came up from working-class background. People don't often know that. So he grew up as a child actor. So he also has a kind of rootedness in the theatrical world that isn't simply the glitz. It's actually the work of the theater. He often said that work is more fun than fun. He was remarkably prodigious, as we pointed out. And he wrote, he was very, very cautious about being public about his sexuality, but he was obviously and clearly and happily gay, in fact, very happily. But he did write in his diaries a wonderful, I encourage people to read it, in 1954, after the British Parliament repassed the repression of homosexuality law. I can't remember the actual title of the law. And he was quite horrified, and he wrote a very beautiful discussion in his diary about what this meant and how homosexuality was always around forever and ever. It was a minority in every country. It was absolutely barbaric what the government had done. And that he compared it, as people have more recently, with prejudice against blacks, foreigners, all sorts of other things, women. So he was very astute, and I think that's part of the way in which Coward recuperates some progressive aspects of his political thinking.
And I'm thinking, as he goes into the 1950s, I'm just going to read four lines from a song, because I think the poetic quality and the lyricism of his verse just stands up. And it's, there are bad times just around the corner, there are dark clouds hurtling through the sky. And it's no good whining about a silver lining, for we know from experience they won't roll by. With a scowl and a frown, we'll keep our peckers down and prepare for depression and doom and dread. We'll go to unpack our troubles from our old kit bag and wait until we all drop dead. So I think he had that kind of ominous feel, which if you were, as I was, living in Britain in the 1950s, a period of ration books, it's post-war, it's a little grey, a little dreary. And I think just from a social historian's point of view, you could almost read the first 70 years of the 20th century by focusing on some of the writings of Coward. And I always say in a very sincere and non-critical way that one of Coward's attraction was that he was deeply superficial. Mm-hmm. And I say that as a positive, because he managed to catch those nuances in society that if you were scrambling for your next cup of tea, you probably didn't get. And I think that's part of his charm and part also of what we're talking about in being deeply conservative in some aspects of social drama.
I would add one thing. Coward was absolutely had no interest in religion. In fact, he was very anti-religious. He thought that the church, God, all that was pie in the sky, the silver lining, as you remember. So there was a kind of realist quality to Coward, in spite of all of the ostensible froth and fluff and cleverness. And also a man who was, although he had many, many partners, and particularly a lifelong partner, Graham Payne, from World War II till his death, But Coward was, in some sense, unlucky in love, and he wrote some of the most beautiful, beautiful love songs, almost always with a sense that goodbye is imminent and that you need to carpe diem, you need to grab the moment because it will pass. And they're very poignant, I find. The man had all sorts of depth, but his public persona was one of I am moving lightly through the world like cigarette smoke and champagne bubbles.
Now, we've got the Cabaret coming up. And I'm just wondering, with the Cabaret coming up, if you can tell us about a few of the songs that are going to be performed.
Oh, I'd love to. Well, some of them are classic. You mentioned Mad Dogs and Englishmen, which you may not know. He wrote on a car trip from in the 30s from Hanoi to Saigon, and he wrote it without any paper or pencil. He just composed it in his head and later wrote it down. And it's so clever, wonderful. Mad About the Boy, a wonderful love song about falling in love with someone on the screen. All sorts of people have been interested in who might have been the inspiration for that. In the biography by Philip Orr, he thinks it might be Jimmy Cagney. I'll See You Again, and my favorite song of all, one of my favorites of his, and the most wonderful song in the Cabaret, sung by Samantha Williams, absolutely gorgeous, called If Love Were All. If Love Were All, I Would Be Lonely. It's a beautiful song.
And when does the Cabaret performance, when does that begin?
We start next week, Thursday through Sunday, 5 performances a week for 2 weeks. And then this week, Hay Fever closes. We have 4 performances tonight, tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday matinee.
And Hay Fever is at the Stamford Repertory Theatre, and the Cabaret is at the Nitre Theatre.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's correct. The Stamford Repertory Theatre is the name of the company. The actual location for the Stamford Rep show, Hay Fever, is Piggott Theatre, which is behind Memorial Auditorium on the Stamford campus. And the Nitre is in Old Union across from the bookstore. Let me reiterate that the company is professional. We pay everyone, and it's not just student theatre.
So there you are, many opportunities in the next few days to see Hay Fever, to see the many different songs from the Noel Coward Cabaret, all down there at Stamford at the University on campus, one at the Piggott Theatre and the other at the Nitre Theatre. So perhaps we can go out with just something from the master himself, just to remind us this is what he really sounded like. And again, thanks, Rush, for coming in and giving us this background on Noel Coward.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And the sea will bill and will coo, and sorrow will never come, or will it ever come to our room with a view. Someday I'll find you, moonlight behind you, true to the dream I am dreaming. As I draw near you, you'll smile a little smile. For a little while, we shall stand hand in hand.
The program is Open Air, KALW's regular Thursday afternoon program of things culturally considered here around the Bay Area. If you want to hear this program again, in just not too long from now, this program will be posted on our KALW.org website, and all the information that you heard will be capsulized, and you can be able to hear it again as well. This is that Cyrus Chestnut piece I was trying to play for you a little bit earlier. This is Naima's love song. He's performing as part of the Jazz at Lesher series. I'm Kevin Vance. David LaTulipe will be your host, returning here on Open Air this time next week. Many thank yous to the real star of the show, Neil Swinkles, who put this program together. Thank you to Peter Robinson for that wonderful segment about Noel Coward, and everybody for all their good work in keeping the arts alive here in the Bay Area. Well done, everyone. Thank you.